Экстренное включение из информационной студии «Дождя».
В Геленджике объявлен режим чрезвычайной ситуации.
Накануне вечером на Кубани обрушились ливневые дожди.
Главной темой дня – разрушительному наводнению на Кубани.
Сильные дожди стали виновниками.
За ночь количество жертв на побережье выросло.
Растет число жертв на Кубани, по последним данным ЧС.
It's a scenario we've seen play out time and time again. A humanitarian disaster strikes, and the Kremlin is caught flat-footed. Relief efforts flounder. Weaknesses in infrastructure, inspection procedure, and oversight are exposed. Promises of reform are made and not kept. Public anger mounts and then subsides until the next disaster hits. From the explosion at Sayano-Shushenskaya power plant back in 2009, to the raging forest fires of the summer of 2010, to the sinking of the Bulgaria River cruise ship almost exactly a year ago in the summer of 2011, and in many other cases, the script has been almost identical. And so it was with last week's floods in southern Russia. The Kremlin's relief and rescue efforts have been roundly condemned as callous and inadequate. Residents of Krymsk and other towns were given no warning when heavy rain sent a wall of water rushing through their streets and homes in the early morning hours of July 7th, even though the authorities knew hours in advance that a flash flood was possible. Moreover, journalists have identified an aging reservoir, co-owned by a former deputy energy minister, as one of the key culprits for the severity of the floods. And this latest disaster couldn't come at a worse time for the ruling elite, with trust in the authorities declining precipitously and dissent on the rise. Humanitarian disasters and their political consequences. Hello and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studios with me is my regular co-host, back from vacation, Kirill Kobrin, managing editor of RFERL's Russian service. Welcome, Kirill.
Hello.
Kirill, we've seen Vladimir Putin weather storms like this before and come out unscathed, or in some cases come out even stronger. Early in his presidency, of course, he was criticized for his handling of the sinking of the Kursk nuclear submarine, but suffered little, if any, political damage. And he actually managed to use the Beslan hostage tragedy in September 2004 to increase his power, subordinating regional governors to the Kremlin, and in the process, strengthening his power vertical. But this began to change, I think, with the forest fires that raged through Russia two summers ago. The government's weak response to those fires sparked what at the time was unprecedented criticism of Putin personally. But those fires also turned out to be an engine for civil society, as ordinary citizens, most famously Dr. Lisa, organized volunteer rescue efforts that shamed the state. Just as the Beslan crisis strengthened Putin's power vertical, the fires of 2010 seemed to weaken it and strengthen civil society's power horizontal, if you will. Now, are we seeing a continuation of that process with the floods in the south? What do you think, Kirill?
I'm not sure. Well, first of all, disasters happen everywhere. And usually, the response of the authorities and the states usually is weak, or rather weak. Don't forget about, you know, Katrina in the United States or Fukushima in Japan and so on. The problem is not the response, authorities' response, governmental response, state response to the disaster. It's very important, of course, as a human cost of the tragedy and so on. But we are discussing now the politics, the political dimension of the problem. And in this case, there is some difference between the political implications of such disasters as, you know, the tsunami in South Eastern Asia several years ago, or Katrina or Fukushima, because there are various political contexts in these countries, in these regions, and so on. So we are speaking about Russia, and we are speaking about the, as you put it, society. Mm-hmm. Society's power horizontal and power vertical. So if we are speaking about how the situation is affecting the society, public opinion, and the state, there are three various questions. As if we speak about the state, Putin's regime, and so on, I can claim that no regime in the world, whatever it could be, a democracy or, you know, authoritarian regime or totalitarian regime, no one regime is prepared to such disasters, because the very nature of humankind, the very nature of human consciousness is not based on the idea that the disaster could happen just every second. Yes, normally the state is prepared to some extent to such events and so on. But the extent or the level of these preparations are various. It's up to not to just the efficiency of the state, the efficiency of the regime, the efficiency of the political or administrative mechanism, but another part of the story is it's a public attitude or society's attitude to this regime, to the state, and to the probability of such disasters. There are two questions. I am a little bit academic, pardon.
No, that's okay.
The level of the preparations to such events are various because of state. Of the state and the authorities and so on, and the state of society and of kind of public opinion and the very mechanism of how the society works. So let's discuss these two things. Okay. First of all, so the state of authorities, the mechanism of a state, you know, infrastructure and so on. Of course, the response of the authorities for the disaster, such disasters, is based on this situation. Russian state, post-Soviet state, I'm not speaking about Soviet times, I don't know. I even don't know. I don't know how, for instance, Finland or Western Germany will deal with Chernobyl. I'm not sure. Yeah. I don't know. I just don't know. But I know something about the post-Soviet Russia. So in these 20 years, the government and the state is never prepared for such events. Never. The question is why. First answer, corruption. Second answer is lack of professionalism. Both of these things are common all over the world, by the way. But the third one is very important. The lack of public support to the state.
Lack of public support
to the state? Public support, yes, yes. Because public, so the society, is deeply irritated and gravely doesn't trust the state and
the
bureaucracy.
Lack of trust, the lack of public trust.
Yes, yes, yeah, you can call it a credibility gap or whatever. So the state could be efficient just in the case when the society is supporting it. Yeah,
with trust.
With trust. With trust. With the efforts, because efforts is the consequence of the trust. Public efforts is the result of this trust. When I want to help someone, I have to trust these people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and when we see all this public activity during this disaster or during these fires,
the fires two years ago, 2 summers ago, yeah,
yes, and Beslan and whatever, what do we see? We see that the public activity is absolutely parallel to the governmental efforts.
You mean the volunteer efforts?
Yes,
to try?
Yes, they don't support their states' efforts to handle the disaster, to deal with the disaster. They just live in absolutely another world. It's very interesting. It looks like in Krimsk there are two Krimsk in the world. One is for the state, for the official TV and for official MCS ministry and so on, and there are another one for the internet community, for the social networking, and for the public volunteers. There are two realities, even in such situation, in such crucial situation.
The same was the case with the fires.
Yes.
Same was the case with the fires.
That's
which was to me, that was the crucial change during the fires, the volunteerism. And I saw this a little bit differently. What I saw with the fires was, and this was because of the advances in social media, because of the coming of age of civil society in Russia, you saw volunteer efforts filling in a gap where the state was unable or unwilling to fill. The state couldn't get the job done, so Dr. Lisa went and got the job done, you know, to put it, you know, crudely. And that to me was a major breakthrough for Russian civil society. of that we can take care of this ourselves. We don't have to rely on the state, especially if the state is going to be. Now, an ideal situation would be where you have civil society and the state in a situation like this working, you know, together and toward the same goal. But you don't. We haven't seemed to have seen that. And in fact, this time, the state, especially local officials in Krymsk, have been outwardly hostile to volunteers coming.
Yes, that's why I'm saying that. Just imagine such disaster, you know, in UK. What would in this situation public will do? The public will help the state.
Mm-hmm.
Will help the state, the local councils and ministry, emergency teams and mm-hmm. whatever. But they will focus on helping the state to deal the situation.
I don't have to imagine. I've never lived through a Katrina, but I've lived through my fair share of pretty serious hurricanes in the U.S. And mm-hmm. yeah, you basically listen. The instinct is to listen to
the
authorities.
To help the police.
You trust them.
You
believe they're working towards your best interest.
Yeah, but it's not a Russian case.
No.
That's why I'm speaking about two realities.
Yeah.
Two parallel realities in public opinion and public consciousness. We are speaking just now, not now about the disasters and about the medical and some other context of this. Yes, we are speaking about the politics and we are mm-hmm. speaking about the public opinion and mm-hmm. public consciousness. So in public consciousness, there are two realities. One reality is official Krymsk, official TV, mm-hmm. and official efforts to save everything and official corruption and official lie and whatever. Other world, other reality is unofficial Krymsk
mm-hmm.
and a much graver degree of the disaster
mm-hmm.
and absolutely other population of the
right.
Krymsk and absolutely parallel efforts to save lives and to help them and so on. They even don't try to help state authorities to deal with this disaster, with the strategy. They just working just parallelly. So this is the most interesting thing. Russia is deeply divided into two, at least two parts.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the most serious and I think the most dangerous consequence on such events. Because with every such disaster and so on, this gap between two realities is beginning wider and wider, deeper and deeper.
And becoming more and more visible.
Yes.
And more visible.
That's where speaking about trust, about this gap, credibility gap and so on.
Now, this is all not happening in a vacuum. This is happening at a time of, I'm reluctant to use the word unprecedented, but in terms of a very serious political turbulence in Russia, in society, in the elite. What kind of effect, let's put this into context, what effect is this all going to have? Is this exposing anything that wasn't exposed before? Is it exacerbating any tensions that already existed? How do you see this fitting into the context of the current political climate?
I told this, this being or living in two parallel realities, I told that it's very dangerous, but it's not very dangerous just for the state, for Putin himself and his elite.
Mm-hmm.
It's very dangerous for opposition or public, opposition, public opinion, and so public activists, social mm-hmm. activists. Why? This is kind of escapism.
Mm.
You know, you are inventing your own reality, your own Krymsk, your own people, with no any connections with the state. And you inventing your own politics, you inventing your own heroes, and it's more interesting, you are inventing your own impact
mm-hmm.
on the events and so on. You are dreaming about your own, importance.
Mm-hmm.
It's very important, yes.
But aren't the volunteers helping real people and having real results?
Yes,
isn't that happening?
Yes. The problem is
it's not virtual reality. It's not a video game. It's really happening. People are really going to Krymsk and are really helping real people.
Yes, but who knows? I'm not objecting all these efforts. for sure. I am not the enemy of the humankind, yeah? But sometimes these volunteers' help and so on is not efficient because they cannot connect to state, MCS members or...
Right. Because of the lack of trust.
Yes, they don't trust them, and that's why they sometimes they do the same thing parallelly and just
when you say they don't trust them, what does that mean in practice? What do they think is going to happen if they
for instance some governmental people is coming to some place point A, mm-hmm. for instance, and is telling the local population is terribly needed, for instance, water.
Mm-hmm.
And the volunteers, they don't trust them, and they bring their, rice, mm-hmm. or some clothes, or whatever. So they don't trust any word from their side, from the state, uh-huh. And that is why... It's another example. That's why no any more court decision in Russia is trustful. We don't know, or Russian public don't know who is the real criminal and who is an innocent people, because they don't trust courts and the judicial system as a whole, as a phenomena. Because they don't trust the state, they don't trust the courts, they don't trust, policemen, they don't trust teachers, they don't trust... This is a disaster. This is a real disaster.
So what I hear you saying is that these floods in the south, or any disaster that we've seen in Russia, the fires of 2010, are almost a microcosm for the metaphor, yeah. almost for the level of distrust that you feel in society. Just as volunteers don't trust MCS workers, emergency ministry workers, for the same reason, they don't trust court decisions. They don't trust the police. No, so nothing is true.
Nothing is true, save our own feelings and our own understanding. So it's a kind of new individualism in Russia, but it's not based on, as it was in Western history, it's not based on Protestantism, on some religious values and so on. Western individualism is based on Age of Enlightenment or on Protestant ethics, like Max Weber wrote about this, and so on. This is an individualism, new Russian individualism, which is based absolutely on the zero, on nihilism.
I was actually thinking the exact same thing, nihilism.
Yeah.
Belief in nothing.
And this thing is another very dangerous point of our understanding of the situation. It's kind of atomization of the society. Because this is this disrespect to any connections with the state, it's absolutely stupid for the state itself. This is the beginning.
And it's mutual. There's contempt. There seems to be contempt on the part of the state for individuals.
Sure, they don't. Just Putin himself, especially Putin himself, and all this elite, they don't have any respect for so-called plain people of Russia.
So what does this portend? I mean, what does this tell us about where this situation may be going? And in the second half of the podcast, we're going to discuss a little bit about where things might be going in the autumn. But what does this suggest? Given the political crisis,
as I told you, it's first of all, I think when I was on the, as you told me that I returned, told our audience that I just returned from the vacations. Mm-hmm. So during the vacation, I was thinking about Russia.
Uh-huh. You were in the UK, but you were thinking about Russia.
In Wales, moreover.
In Wales.
speaking seriously, I was thinking about this situation, and I decided that it's more Much more serious, much more grave than I thought about it.
You've been pretty gloomy lately.
Yes, but now I am just alarmist.
Supposed to be my role. You're supposed to be the calming kind
But speaking seriously, you know, it's not just a political crisis. It's kind of existential crisis,
it's an existential crisis.
Because if you are trying to establish your own individualism, your own kind of lack of trust to everything in your world on just this nihilism, it's very dangerous. Because how can you produce any values? Because the values are just a foundation for the society. There is no any ideology. This is a very deep lack of respect to Orthodox Church, which deepens just now because of all this Pussy Riot story and so on.
And the church isn't helping matters, and the state isn't helping matters by charging Pussy Riot with blasphemy. I mean, what are we in the Inquisition?
Absolutely. They made a very serious public problem from a very, just not very serious situation, just from the one of the performances of modern artists. That's all.
Yeah.
You have to be just an absolute, political fool if you're doing such things from such a, from political point of view, from such a rubbish.
And from, according to Pussy Riot, they didn't actually even really play the concert inside the Christ the Savior Cathedral. Yeah. They went in and made a little disruption.
It was a video clip,
and then they montaged the video where they played in another location into there.
Just several seconds, and that's all.
And this, they... So it's really unclear what they're being prosecuted for at this point. But the blasphemy, I think this is one of the cases where the state got caught telling the truth, because this is actually what they're really prosecuting.
I read the text of official charges, and I read that the main point is that these girls, they try to undermine the ageless foundation of Russian Orthodox Church. It's stupid.
That's in the criminal code? Is that in the criminal code?
No. Sure.
Undermining the ageless tradition of the Russian Orthodox Church, if that is in the criminal code, I would be very surprised.
It's
right.
Not a crime. And so summarizing everything, all these things, so it's a deep credibility gap in Russian society. It's a very serious existential and political as a result of this crisis. And this is not a crisis or, you know, the fight of opposition against the state or elite of Putin himself. Now, from now on, I think, from the Pussy Riot case, from this Krimsk tragedy and so on, this is, I think, the beginning of a wide crisis situation on various levels of Russian life.
So it is existential, actually.
Yes, yeah.
Well, this is a very good segue to what we're going to talk about in the second half of the program. In a few minutes, we'll shift gears slightly and discuss a related topic. Russia is about to enter its so-called cucumber season, the traditional summer lull in the political season, before things heat up again in the fall. So with the authorities and the opposition gearing up for another round of conflict, where do things stand? I'd like to remind you that you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me is my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin, managing editor of RFERL's Russian service, who is back from vacation in the UK. I'd also like to remind you that you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at RFERL.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical.
Государственная Дума завершает свою работу. Сегодня последнее заседание.
Закона о клевете.
Сегодня же Госдума приняла в первом чтении другой громкий законопроект.
Государственная Дума накануне приняла во втором и третьем чтениях законопроект об ограничениях.
Около здания Госдумы России сегодня проходят пикеты против принятия.
It's been a week on steroids for the State Duma as the lower house sprinted through legislation establishing tighter regulation of the internet, placing tough new restrictions on NGOs, and reinstating criminal penalties for libel. All three bills appear designed to stifle a resurgent opposition and restore the unrestricted and uncontested dominance of President Vladimir Putin's Kremlin after more than 6 months of noisy street protests and open dissent. And lawmakers clearly wanted to get the controversial Kremlin-backed bills off their docket before the summer recess kicks in. But while what Russians call cucumber season may be upon us, Kremlin watchers say this year's traditional July-August lull in the political season is but a brief pause before the political storm expected to engulf the political class in the autumn. In a thoughtful, persuasive, and much-discussed article in the Daily Vyedomosti this week, political analyst Kirill Rogov argued that a political crisis is bound to heat up once the weather cools off. And he cataloged a whole series of areas where the ruling elite is in trouble. But at the heart of his argument is a simple and possibly irreconcilable conflict. While most Russians accept Vladimir Putin as the country's legitimate ruler, an equally clear majority, as well as a sizable chunk of the elite, does not want him to rule in the heavy-handed and unaccountable way he did during his first stint in the Kremlin from 2000 to 2008. But nevertheless, Putin seems determined to do so anyway. Kirill, the summer's political break feels sort of like halftime at a football match. A football match that's been going on since last December. So if that's the case...
Elephant games.
Yeah. What's the score now, and how is the second half shaping up? Because this does feel like we're going to catch our breaths for a couple of months right now, and then this is all going to heat up again in August. And I want to discuss Rogov's article, but I want to discuss other things that are coming up in the autumn as well. How do you see things shaping up right now?
Well, first of all, if we are speaking about the game, my question is, who is playing the game? What are the teams and so on? By the way, about some relaxation or some, you know, relax. You told about cucumber season. Usually it followed by pickled cucumber and vodka season in Russia, you know. Малосольные огурцы. Returning to our subject. So who is playing? Who is playing? There are various, versions of the answers to this question. Well, first of all, we can say, just in the terms of Cold War Sovietology, KGB is playing against Russian people. Mm-hmm. Yes. And I think a lot of Western analytic, articles and opinions, just they... arranged in such way of thinking, still KGB against Russian people. Mm-hmm. I think we'll dismiss this idea.
Yeah, I think that's a little simplistic.
Yes.
Yeah.
secondly, state against the society. It's wrong.
I think that's wrong, too. Yeah.
It's wrong, too. Putin's elite against the opposition.
Closer, but not... on the mark yet, I would say.
Yeah.
I mean, that's closer to the truth than the first two you hit, but I think Putin's elite is a very complicated and not exactly a unified thing,
yeah,
as Rogov pointed out in his article.
Yeah.
And society is not a unified thing, and as Rogov pointed out. And the opposition itself is not a unified thing. So, no, but I'd say that's a bit closer to the mark.
So how can we speak about the game? returning to our initial question. Yes, who is playing? Who is playing with him? With who? So, what are the teams? I'm not sure that this is kind of a game. This is in the terms of physics or biology. So it's kind of activity of some political matter. Yeah, this is a period of an activity, or this was the period of the activity of some political matter.
But it's a very dynamic matter, right?
Yes.
Now. There's a lot of, it's going through a lot of volatility. Sometimes there is static matter.
Yeah.
You know, as in the Brezhnev period of stagnation or Zastoy, or the early part of the Putin presidency.
You have
volatile periods such as the Yeltsin period, Perestroika. We're in a volatile period right now.
So
what are the elements? Let's change the metaphor.
Yeah.
Let's shift from sports to physics. What are the elements here? What's that? Who's that play? Because I mean, there is another point in Rogov's piece that really jumped out. There were two points in that article that I think really jumped out at me. The first one I stated in my introduction, basically this very simple contradiction where Putin, majority of Russians, a clear majority, say, you're the legitimate president. We accept that. But also
40%. Something about
60% says, 60. But an equally clear majority and almost as high, about 60, say, but we don't want you to behave like you did last time.
Yeah.
We want you to behave. They don't say it this way, but a little bit more like Medvedev behaved when he was president. We wanted we want Medvedev in Putin's clothes, I guess, or Putin in Medvedev's clothes. I don't know what you. But Putin seems to be determined to go back to 2007. He just seems. That's point one of Rogov's art. And Rogov made that point very clearly and I think very succinctly. The second point I thought was a little bit more nuanced, but just as important. The second point was he breaks down public opinion and says, OK, usually we say it's, 60-40, 65-35 in favor of Putin against Putin. He says, but let's break that down a little bit. Putin's hardcore support, 15 to 20%. Putin's hardcore opposition, about 15%.
The same. Right?
Then you have Then you have another, if I remember correctly, another 20 or so percent that is sympathetic to the anti-Putin, and another 40% or so that is 40 to 50% that's leaning toward Putin. But the argument is that as Putin begins to behave like the Putin of 2000 to 2008, this soft pro-Putin part of the electorate is going to drift to the other side. And the elite is also going to move in that direction because a majority of they're not going to want to be against a majority of the public. So it's this complicated dynamic between the elite and the public. And Rogov's arguing that by all of these laws, the law on NGOs, the law on the internet, the reestablishing libel restoring criminal penalties for libel, is going to push the soft part of the elite that's of the public that's supporting Putin into the opposition to him, and it's going to push a majority of the elite against him, and this is going to become obvious in the fall. This is the second part of his argument. And when you look at the Duma today passed the law on libel, but it softened it. It took the criminal penalties. It took the prison terms out of the libel, and it's still a stiff fine. Yeah. But on the internet law, they softened a little bit. On the NGO law, they softened. They softened everything a little bit, almost like they see this, and they managed to get votes from a Just Russia as a result of this in the Duma. So it wasn't just passed along party lines. So, what do you think? Is Rogov right? Are we headed for a decisive crisis come fall?
I'm not sure that the crisis will be in such forms as Kirill Rogov predicts, but I agree with him in some common things, some wider things. First of all, so we cannot discuss, if we return to our metaphor about the matter and so on, we can discuss the structure of this matter, mm-hmm. and we can discuss a mechanism of the consequences of this activity, of the results. Yeah, so we can discuss the structure of public opinion today in Russia, and secondly, we can discuss the mechanism of political crisis, mm-hmm. of would-be political crisis, and the historical political crisis or political crisis in Russian history. Yeah, we can. I can claim that the mechanism of such political crisis in Russian 20th century is not the same, but it's just
similar.
It's similar, yeah, it's similar. And the most interesting thing in this that this mechanism is not such strongly connected to the political, economical, and social context. Mm. For instance, situation in Russia in January 1917 was not so deeply bad,
right,
as it seems.
That's true.
The situation was much worse in the middle of 1915 when Russian army left Poland and so on, and that was a very serious irritation against Nicholas II and his circle and so on. Second example is 1991. I think the most dangerous point of perestroika was in 1989 and 1990, but not in 1991.
You mean when the Congress of People's Deputies first convened and the revolutions in Eastern Europe?
Yes, and the situation, the economic and the social situation, and all this, situation with food and whatever. It was worse. In 1989 and 1990, not in 1991.
I'd have to take your word for that, since I didn't arrive until 91.
So I can tell a lot of things about these times. Yeah. So this is just two examples of this.
Now, in each of those cases, there was 2 years before the crisis in the fall.
We are not the astrologists and so on. But anyway, the political crisis usually in Russia, I don't know how it's in the United States. I can speak about France, for instance. I know French history or UK. But in Russia, it's usually the crisis just followed after several years, followed the worst situation in the decade, for instance. I think today it's I don't want to be treated like a prophet, but this year is the best year in some sense for the beginning of political crisis in these terms, because the worst situation, economic situation, social situation, it was during the crisis in 2008.
Right, although Russia did much better in that crisis, thanks to Kudrin's stabilization fund.
Yeah.
Than I had thought at the time. I thought Russia was in deep trouble at that time.
Yeah.
It looked for a time like they were in deep trouble. But they managed to get through it, and this was—I mean, a lot of this. I have to give credit to Kudrin's economic stewardship there, because he really did get through this.
And by the way, let's speak some good words about the Medvedev presidency in 2008. Yeah. Not just in our ethical attitude to this time, but speaking from the point of view of polit-technologies and so on, it was a very good politics in this year and political cause, because all this crisis meant nothing to political situation, just nothing. Mm-hmm. And everything began 3 years later.
Yeah.
So this is my first point about the political crisis. Mm-hmm. The second point is it's about the structure of this political and social matter in Russia. Yes, and we just spoke about this atomization, this existential crisis, and so on, so on. My point is that the real politics in Russia will begin not just from, as we told a lot of time, from the grassroots movements and regions and so on. The second part of this process is a very strict definition, political definition of the interests of various groups of the population. Mm-hmm. For instance, when we discussed this metaphor about the football game and so on, we spoke about KGB against people or state against the society and so on. But we even didn't mention rights against the lefts.
Well, no, because I'm not sure what is the right and what is the left anymore in Russia, or if ever. But
that is my point. When the people, when the society just will begin to decide what do they want from the politics?
Yeah.
If they are, leftists or neoliberals or so on, just not in these terms, but somehow to decide if they support privatization or just for state economy, or they against this or they support this. I think the real political process will begin from this point, from the end of this atomization, from the end of this lack of trust or credibility gap everywhere, mm-hmm. between every people's, groups, social groups, social circles, social classes, state and society, and so on. So if you want to be involved in real politics, you have to trust someone,
mm-hmm.
and to share some opinions.
But for the time being, and you're right, I think you're right in the long term, definitely. You're right in the long term. But for the time being, the battle lines are different. They're not left and right. They are, I don't know what to call it.
Well,
I
mean, democracy against authoritarian regime, but Sergei Udaltsov is not
a Democrat. Yes. Exactly. this is the problem.
And I'm very dubious about Navalny, for instance, in this sense.
I mean, Navalny and Udaltsov do represent the left and right poles, to speak, of the... Or the respectable left
yes,
and right
because
poles
Navalny,
of the opposition.
He's, I think, a very good pupil of Ayn Rand and whoever.
As is Prokhorov.
Yes, yes. So we can't discuss just what the politics
but
means.
But before you can get to the point where you have this more mature system that you're kind of political culture is that you're talking about.
Yeah.
It has to get by this current crisis. I mean, and this is really, and I still keep going back to this. This is what I thought really where the elite was going when I thought that the Medvedev presidency was going to continue for another term. Putin was going to fade into the background like Deng Xiaoping and be really the lord of the system, but let it proceed. And then, you're going to have Surkov creating his fake left and fake right parties in the Duma, and then eventually these things would turn into the real thing. It would almost be like this periodny period that everybody talked about, this transition period that everybody talked about in the 90s. But this time it would be real, and it would be they would have directed this, and then you would have gotten real politics out of that eventually, right? That didn't happen. As for just reasons we've discussed in this podcast before, portions of the elite got scared, got nervous. They decided to keep Putin in place, and so now we have this kind of standoff, and it's unclear where it's going to go. The other way, this thing may have been resolved in a relatively quiet, peaceful, kind of orderly manner. Maybe this way, I don't. And if Putin had come in and been a different Putin, but not tried to be the Putin of 2004, for example, but had been a different version of himself, I guess, and tried to be a reformer, tried to be Pyotr Stolypin or something, then maybe we would have seen this happen. But that's not where it's clearly not where they're going.
No, no.
And so that you have a hardening on both sides of the barricade, so to speak. And I frankly don't see how this is going to be resolved.
Me too. Hopefully, I hope it will end up with political crisis,
and not a
war of everyone against everyone.
Do you think that's
political chaos and so on?
Because that'll only benefit the most extremist elements.
Yes, but don't forget that Putin has pretty much support from his true supporters, 15-20% of hardcore fans. It's pretty much. Yeah. Yes, it's enough for serious positions in this game, if you are speaking about the game. Secondly, if no one can define his political, economical, and social interests in words,
right,
in some vocabulary, so instead of words, what will appear?
Well, on Friday the 13th, I'm almost scared to end the podcast on that note.
It's kind of an Orwellian discussion.
But that's unfortunately all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you that you've been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me has been my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin, managing editor of RFERL's Russian service. Thanks for the great discussion, Kirill, and it's good to have you back.
Thank you.
And also a big thanks to our awesome producer, Tanya Konchova, who keeps everything running smoothly here in the studio and who, as promised, kept all the evil spirits and supernatural phenomenon out of our studios on this Friday the 13th. I'd also like to remind you, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org. You can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical. See you again next week, and as always, now I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.